Hi everyone, welcome to Evoke Therapy Program's broadcast. It is November 1st, 2018.
I may have shared in recent broadcasts that I've spent the last couple of months in the field with a group. My partner, Dr. Matt Hoy, was on sabbatical, and so I had offered to cover his group while he was gone. And while it was a challenge in terms of my schedule, it was absolutely phenomenal in terms of reconnecting to the clients in the field in a way that I don't get to do when I'm supervising or just making field visits to the various groups. So I'm very grateful for that. And what comes out of that is a lot of times lessons that are fresh for me, points of emphasis that are fresh for me. And that's where this particular broadcast comes from, is this place of what I was seeing in the field between the clients, the students, and our field staff, and of course the parallel process that goes on with parents. In fact, one of the staff asked me in in-service this week the question, as I was kind of teaching about this idea of being an adequate container and slowing down before getting to the point where you start to give your anecdotes in your lectures and providing a safe space for the child to express their griefs and their wounds and their anger and their pain. And one of the staff said, it's kind of like in your book, What You Teach Parents. Is that the same kind of process that you're describing? And I said, absolutely. That's a really good catch. It's the exact same process, only with this difference. It's a lot harder to do with parents than it is with staff. As a parent, I'm much more compromised than I am as a therapist. The first chapter of my book where I tell the story of that young man that was with me, Adam is what I called him, and where he was sharing the grief of the loss of his mother. And while the trigger that day was about the group and the argument that he was getting in, that's why I asked him to take some space, it really brought up for him the pain and the loss of his mother. His mother was somebody that got him more than anybody, even his father, who was a wonderful father and absolutely well-intended. And I sat there on that broken down fence in the rain that day with the recognition that I didn't have a solution to this one. I didn't have a look on the bright side or silver lining to this one. All I had was my presence to sit with him and share in his pain. And I say in the book that therapists call this containing and parents call this impossible. So there's a difference in the difficulty, the challenge of the process, but the actual skill itself is a very similar process. So I'm going to take you through a thought process with regard to when is it time for instruction? When is it time for somebody to hear the anecdote and the story? And this comes out of a fresh example in the field where a young man was sharing part of his trauma, part of his pain. And when I stopped and paused after listening to it, validating his pain, I asked several members of the group and even the staff, can you connect him? Can you empathize and understand him? And people went to leading questions, the questions that really they were trying to get him to see the lesson. Somebody even shared an anecdote that trivialized this young man's pain. And when I interrupted this after a few attempts and kind of modeled for them what it looked like to connect to somebody after they'd shared their pain, one of the staff members pulled me aside afterwards and he said, when's the time for instruction? When's the time for guidance? He actually gave me this hypothetical as an illustration of the question. He said, let's say two children had been abused by their father growing up. And they had talked to each other and shared with each other that experience. He said, there's no growth in that, right? There's no change in that. And so where's the growth in it? Just sharing and being heard. And I first said to him, first, I think there's a flaw in your assumption. It is, I think a lot of us could empathize with this. It's a dramatically different experience when you can talk to somebody about your pain, your abuse, and be heard. There's a dramatic difference between the hypothetical that you just gave me and the hypothetical situation which happens very often in life where you get abused and you don't tell anybody for years. That's a different experience. You internalize it more to be about yourself. And maybe you did something wrong and that maybe you're the crazy one. Versus if two siblings are talking, there's some sense that they're not crazy, that they're not imagining it, that it's real, that the pain, the anger is deserved. So that's the first challenge I had to. The second point that I made is it's different. The problem with the question is there are times for discussion. There are times for instruction. But they have to come after the person feels safe. And so that's what I'm going to talk about tonight. First of all, I talk about this all the time. Children come with defenses. Right? Those defenses are evidence of wound or threats. Right? That's why we have defenses. When I talk about honoring defenses, I'm saying validate them. Say, it makes sense that you do this. It's hard for us as parents. I've told you this story in recent months that when we sent my son on a wilderness adventure this summer, my wife wrote a beautiful letter wherein she said, it's not lost on me the irony that I'm asking you to get rid of some of the defenses that you put up in response to the hurt that we caused. And I thought that was a profoundly courageous and insightful comment by my wife. So children come with the defenses, and if we learn to honor them, we make it safe, and we follow them, like I say, like a trail of crumbs back to the original wound. And when we do that and see it and honor the wound, then they can start to heal. But if we just attack the defenses, try to fix the defenses, try to teach the defenses away, or talk about how they're not working, if we do that, especially early on, the response is to build up larger, thicker, more sturdy defenses, or to run away. So we start with understanding the child. You know, the question I get asked all the time is, what if the child is lying? And I think early as a therapist, you thought you were going to develop some skill of perception, that you were going to be able to tell when people were making up the truth, lying, exaggerating. And so you kind of think of yourself as this detective that's going to develop a skill. But after a while, you kind of realize that's not your job and that there's truth even in the lie. And what I mean by that, you know, when people interpret dreams and they my version of interpreting dreams is you just try to hear the themes, the feelings in it. There's some other basic concepts to the dream interpretation, but you try to connect them to what the person is challenged with in their daily life. And dreams are constructed in such a way that they're very abstract and very disorganized. In a way, they're kind of hiding the specific content so as to give you the theme in a raw way. Freud called dreams the royal road to the unconscious. But there's truth in dreams, even though the reality of the dreams is skewed. When I have a child tell me a fantasy of theirs, it's not that I believe the facts of the fantasy, but I'm listening for the themes and the hurt. When I have a child tell me the story about a parent, I don't anymore try to interpret the facts of it. I try to hear what's going on for them. Many years ago, 25 years ago, I had a client who had shared with me that her mother and her priest suggested to her that they thought she was abused by her uncle. And she had no memory of it, but they suggested that it was true. So she came to me to say, I want to find out if my uncle abused me. And I said, I don't know what to do with this. I was a brand new therapist. And so I went to my supervisor and asked her the question, what do I do? She specialized in child abuse. And she said, just go back to the client. This was in college. She was in college. I was in college. Just go back to the client and say, do you think your uncle could have abused you? You have a relationship with him. He's in your home a lot, lives close to you. You have a lot of experience. You feel something like that could have happened. And if she says yes, and then you know that something's there. You don't know the specifics and the content and the facts of it, but something in the relationship is so fractured that something is there. And then pay attention to that. And when she's ready to remember or ready to tell you, then that'll be the time. But you don't have to look into a crystal ball and figure it out. You just have to explore it. So when children are telling us the story, we don't assess the factual basis of it all the time. We just hear the pain, hear the story. And eventually, over time, when they feel safe, the story becomes more and more accurate, more and more squared to objective reality. And I've seen that happen over and over and over again. In fact, it's inevitable. Somebody remains in therapy long enough. That's what happens. Parents worry that we're condoning or reinforcing a victim mentality, right? That the child is manipulating. It's very important for me to say this, that when we develop an ability to be a container, it doesn't require us to compromise our values and our boundaries. Right? We can understand without moving from our spot. The implied boundary, or the boundaries implied by the listening, we can just hear them. So we hear the feeling without condoning or conflating the maladaptive behavior, right? Putting your fist through a wall is not the same as being angry. Putting your fist through a wall is a behavior. Being angry is a feeling. And many people conflate the two. Many people will often say, I got in trouble for being angry. And I say, no, well, you got in trouble for putting a fist through your wall. And maybe your parents are intolerant of your anger, and will teach them to listen to it better, and you're responsible for the behavior. So you can hold your boundaries while still listening. You don't have to move from your spot. You don't have to capitulate. You don't have to compromise your spot if you're clear about it, while still understanding their pain, their sadness, their story. This idea about condoning behavior too, it doesn't condone the behavior. And the person is much more capable of responding to the boundary after they've been heard. I used to talk about thinking of parenting as a very tall brick wall with a big ear painted on it, right? That's kind of our visual representation of the aspiration of healthy parenting, is having solid boundaries and having a much better listening ear. I get a lot of invitations to talk. And one of the most common requests is, how do we talk so that our children will listen? Sometimes I'll even title my talk across the country. And of course, I really shift it to, how do we listen so that our children will talk? Right? So many parents will say, I've had parents that upon admission to our program will say, I want my son or my daughter to get in a place where they will listen to me. I want them to get to a place where I can give them my wisdom, my lessons, my awareness, what I've learned in my life. And my response is, that will come someday, but that's not going to be where we start and we spend the majority of their time. See, to plant a seed, you have to till the earth. And when a brain is on fire, talk about that. When a brain is on fire, like our students, like our clients' brains are on fire, there's no ground for planting. It doesn't get in. And besides the fact that they don't really need a lot more data, they have it. You know, I've shared this for years now. Children have asked me many, many times, why? Why did my parents send me here? Why can't I go home? Why can't I talk to my parents? Why can't I go home right after a vote? And in the spirit of Halloween, I don't do it anymore because I've proved the test over and over again. I've said to them, I'll give you a pound of M&M's, one of the big bags of M&M's, pound of Skittles, if you can answer that question, why? To give you some context, a pound of M&M's in their world is about the equivalent of $10,000. So pretend like I'm offering you $10,000. Really, $10,000. But before I can even get the offer on the table, they're giving me a beautiful mini lecture about why, what would be a good reason, a rationale for not going home after a vote. They're not being able to call parents. It's what some analysts call pseudo-stupidity. Pseudo-stupidity is when a person presents as if they don't understand. But that's not what's lacking in them. What's lacking in them is capacity, emotional growth, maturity. And so when we engage this pseudo-stupidity with explanations, with debate, with argument, it doesn't go anywhere because you cannot argue with a drunk. You cannot argue with somebody whose brain is on fire. Being seen is the most important thing. Right? That's everything. It's everything. It is the work that I do with 40 and 50 and 60 year old adults. The work that we do at our intensive. It's the work that I try to do with my own children and fail at and try again and fail at and try again to see them. And the biggest barrier to seeing somebody is anxiety. Let me be crystal clear. Our children do things that trigger all of our anxiety. Our children who need wellness therapy are particularly gifted at doing those things that cause a reasonable parent anxiety. That's true. But we don't give that to them. We go someplace to a therapist, to a listening partner, to a support group, to an Al-Anon meeting, and we express our anxiety and our fear. We kind of burn through it, if you will, lay it there, so that when we're back with the child, we're there for the child. But if we're anxious, even if that anxiety comes from an honest, genuine place, even if we can connect it to our love for the child, when we're anxious, we are in essence asking the child to take care of us. And children that are at Evoke are absolutely incapable of taking care of our anxiety. They're no good at it. So we take care of it so that we might be there for them. It's a fundamental idea. I remember in undergraduate work, we were learning about family systems, and there was one particular chart with four different basic family structures. One was closed, one was open, one was flexible, and one was something else, chaotic. So we're learning about these, the different kinds of rules. You know, in open families, people come in through the back door. In closed families, they only come through the front door. In chaotic families, they come in through the windows. Right? We're just kind of learning about different rules and different what the emotional climate is like. And then we turn the page in this workbook that we're working on with our professor. And she says, but if anxiety is present, all of that's out the door. And I remember thinking at 22 years old, what do you mean if anxiety is present? What anxiety got to do with anything? Anxiety is not even a thing. Most people aren't anxious. And why would that eclipse all of this? Why would it be such an important factor? But 22 years old, I'm thinking that there's no anxiety. And then, of course, in my practice, 30 years later, it's everywhere. It's the enemy of reason. It's the enemy of relationship. It leads to control, to anger, right? It leads to disconnection. It is the thing that we work on in our Al-Anon, our CODA meetings, and our therapy sessions as parents. So for us to be safe, we've got to manage our anxiety elsewhere so that we aren't triggered by our children. And that capacity gets better over time. And nobody's perfect at it. And I fail and struggle with it all the time. The question becomes, how are you not safe? Right? That's what you have control of. How are you not safe? And it's more than if I tell you the truth as your child that I'll get in trouble. There's something more than that. You don't have to not have boundaries, remember? But I had a student recently describe it after a phone call. He said, it was like there was a pressure, he said, that I can't really describe. He said there was an intensity, and he was describing anxiety. He could feel the anxiety. He couldn't name it. It wasn't expressed. The words on paper looked fine, but something about it felt overwhelming to me. I had a mother recently in one of our intensives share that her young adult son, who was struggling, that her anxiety about his struggles was adding to the fuel to the fire. And that her son, if he could speak, was trying to say to her, I'm already struggling, I'm already scared, I'm already overwhelmed, I'm already making mistakes, I'm already beating myself up. When you, mom, show up with your anxiety, it's too much, and so I might need to take space from you. So powerful. How are you not safe? And can you listen to it from your child's perspective? And really what it looks like is being a container is like we're maintaining curiosity, genuine curiosity, not false curiosity. But you don't ask why questions where you know the answer, or you don't use why questions to say you shouldn't feel that way. You ask why questions because you really want to know the answer. Why am I not safe? Why do you feel this way? Tell me, I want to listen and learn. I might not agree with it. It might not resonate with me. But I want to know why. You know, the phenomenal thing about therapy that's really fascinating, people tell me all the time, say to me all the time, tell me my blind spots. Tell me what you see that I don't see. Give me some feedback. I can take it. And I listen to that. And every once in a while, I make the mistake of offering something. And inevitably, what it feels like, because I've been on the receiving end of that with my therapist, is inevitably the response is, you don't get it. You don't understand. Right? Simply, that's not true. I remember my therapist offering her success, suggesting some subtleties 19 years ago when I first started seeing her that now are blatantly obvious to me. But back then, as she was suggesting or offering, I thought she was not very good at her job, actually. More recently, she suggested something. I asked her a question, and she suggested something. And I said, you know, that doesn't resonate with me. But after 19 years of working with you, I have a sense that you may be onto something that I don't see. There's no emotional resonance here, but I have enough experience that you're probably onto something that I'm going to look at. And I even said to her, I said, why did you say that? It kind of went out on one of the tiny branches. And I said, I suspect that you told me that because you thought I might be ready to hear it. And she said, yeah, I thought you might be ready to take a leap. So you remain curious with your child. I wanted to put up this slide. This is a whole different broadcast. You can look at the broadcast on containing, but I wanted to offer this as I was planning this evening. I thought about this slide, this concept of containing, what it means. Containing is like holding space for somebody, listening, empathizing, understanding, offering compassion, non-judgment, and just hearing. From an analyst, it says this: when the contained has a resonant impact on the container, and the response of the container is to empathically accept the contained and subtly modify it by use of the greater resources of the container, i.e. metabolize the contained, right? You take it in, you metabolize it, you make sense of it. In this situation, they go on to say the contained is more or less fully felt and understood by the container. At the same time, the container can rely on additional resources to feed back to the contained a wider sense of the contained experience. Along with this is the experience for the contained that the container can be adequately accept and manage what has been offered to be contained. I know that's a lot of words. It's a scholarly book. I'll leave the slide up there for a moment. You can print it from the parent portal if you want to, or take a screenshot of it now. But that's what it is. You listen to it, you understand it, you reflect back something that shows a deeper interpretation, an empathic deeper interpretation, place of understanding. And the person who shared has an experience of being fully felt. And then expanding just a little bit in their awareness or their reasoning. That's what it means to be a container. And the container doesn't get their needs met in that exchange. Be very clear about it. The parent, the staff member, the therapist does not get their needs met in this exchange. Those needs are met elsewhere. Very, very important to understand. That is why I say, for illustrative purposes, in the last couple of years, I'm almost to the point that I don't want parents to share feelings with the child. I'm not there. But the reason I say that to illustrate, to make a point, is this. The child can't hold them. And it's not the child's job to hold them. It's not the child's job to change behavior because of the way the parent feels. It's simply not. It's not even a reliable source of wisdom. It's not even about the child. It's about the parent. It's okay, it's real, it's valid, but it's not the child's job. And rarely, more and more do I come to realize that the motivation in many, many cases for parents to share the feeling with the child is to get them to change, to get them to respond. In essence, the parent saying, "You're the reason for my upset behaviors. Therefore, change your behavior, show up differently, so I feel at peace and serenity." Right? That's the essence of that communication offer. We rationalize it by saying, "Well, I just want them to know how they impact me." The child, after all, has to learn how they impact people, right? Because that's the way the world works. They've got to recognize their behavior has consequences. That's what we tell ourselves. That's not what really is going on. Not at all. What is going on is we're asking the child to take care of us and our serenity. And the child learns something in this exchange. The child learns to internalize other people's feelings and doesn't learn to develop the self. So when they go out in the world and somebody's upset with them, or sad at something they've done, or angry with something they've done, and by the way, they don't discriminate. It could be a crazy, unhealthy boyfriend or girlfriend, or spouse, or child later on, or friend, or stranger. That the brain doesn't distinguish between those and the parent. And so their experience is, what people think about me is about me. How people feel about me tells me if I'm doing well or not. And we don't want that for them. Right? We don't want them to be vulnerable to influences like that from peers and from unhealthy friends, boyfriends, girlfriends, and so forth. And yet we participate in the wiring that sets them up for that. That's what this containing idea is talking about. So we have to prepare the soil, the plant seed. And it's important to understand that the amygdala, the limbic system, but more specifically the amygdala, is the part of the brain that manages our fight and flight response. The teenage brain, the adolescent brain, I should say, which goes from about 13 to 25. You can read all of Daniel Siegel's books on this. Brainstorming is good. Parenting from the Inside Out is good. He has several others that describe this. He's a scientist, brain scientist from UCLA. The amygdala, when it's on fire, hijacks the higher level thinking, right? When the person feels threatened, reasoning goes away. They can't take in information, rationally make decisions with forethought, anticipating consequences. They can't do that. So if the amygdala is a survival instinct. If the amygdala is on fire, nothing else is working. There's no place to put the seed, the lesson. So first we have to quiet the amygdala. And so how do we do that? We do that by listening, by understanding, by sitting, by having a non-anxious response, a curious response, an open response, an adequate response. Then, and that is an art form, and parents are particularly not good at this. Parents, I do this with my children. We come in much, much too early. People that are more detached are much better at this. You would be better with my children than I am. I would be better with your children than you are, for the most part, generally speaking, of course. then there are opportunities for lessons and anecdotes, lessons and instruction, right? That comes, but only when the amygdala is quieted down, only when the higher level functionings aren't hijacked in this process. We reflective listen, right? That's what we teach at Evoke. We contain the analytical idea that I've been sharing tonight. We empathize. We understand. However crazy the story is, we understand it from their perspective. Parents will say, but what is my job if not to teach? Right? What I say to my therapist is, this is how you do it. We want the same outcome, but there's a way to do it that is more effective, and the way to do it is through this kind of progression. Quiet the amygdala. Folks, it's not even an opinion, it's just science. There are a plethora of studies that show that when a person is in fight or flight, that their higher level brain, their cortex, their prefrontal cortex, that whatever they have of it, is not functioning, period. Does not fire. We know that from ourselves, that when we're feeling threatened, we don't have our most creative, high level thinking until we're calmed down. So teaching comes, but that's not the primary job. The primary job is adequate containment. Sharing the non-lesson with, meaning sharing with them where you have the same challenge. No matter how crazy it is, find some common ground. When they share difficulties with peer pressure, share with them that you worry about people judging you. You might not do the same thing, but share with them your own experience of worrying about keeping up with the Joneses. If you're perfect at it, share examples where you have struggled with it and you can empathize. And don't share the conclusion. Don't share with them all the time how you've gotten over it. And you'll find something profound and amazing happens. What you'll find is that they respond with the lesson because they feel safe, because they don't feel judged, because they're not being told not to feel what they feel, not to think what they think. Leave space for them. I struggle with that. Right? You might imagine that I am a better lecturer at times than I am a listener. Leaving space is more difficult, requires more patience. Sometimes we even lecture to them after they share what they've learned. I've done that. I've heard that. Which is amazing, really. Sometimes the way we can share it that works is we say, well, here's what I have found that works. You know, this works for me. I don't know if it'll work for you. It could be wrong. What if you thought about it this way? I have an idea, a thought. Those are ways we can offer lessons after the ground has been prepared, when they ask for advice. And if they reject it, then you know they're not quite ready. Then you can take a step back from any of those positions. So what are the take-homes for tonight? This is brain science. This is how it works. Like I said, I've trained therapists for decades now. And therapists have the same reaction parents do, which is, but wait, we are here to facilitate and support change. So listening, not fast enough, doesn't work, doesn't offer instruction, doesn't offer growth. My response is, this is how you do it. The brain science is clear. Preparing them to receive a lesson by quieting the amygdala, by being safe, by not attacking the defense, by not rationalizing the defense away, by honoring the defense, understanding the defense. Pseudo-stupidity, right? This idea that it's about more information. It's not about more information. And the opportunities for instruction can be short and infrequent and most likely not needed, but you'll know when it's ready because the person won't be at all defended, won't at all argue, or point out the loopholes in the reasoning. boundaries do a lot of the teaching anyway, right? I remember my daughter, I've told this story before, simple example, but I could give more profound ones. But my daughter said, we had a Rottweiler. He's since passed, but sweetest, most teddy bear dog in the world. Loved him, my best friend for a lot of years. And she wanted him to play on the couch, be up on the couch. And one of the rules was this 140-pound dog doesn't get to be on the couch. And my, at the time, probably 7-year-old daughter said, it's so unfair that Coda can't be on the couch. I said, I know, isn't it? And she said, so he can? And I said, no, but I know it's unfair. And so even in that, it kind of illustrates that a flaw in my parenting history with her, right? That when I empathized with her, she thought I was giving her permission. But I'm trying to do it differently, and so I'm saying, I can empathize with you and still have the boundary. I call it the grocery store lecture in my book, right? You say something that one or two sentences, then you send your child to go get the milk. You end the conversation after two sentences. So your child's eyes don't glass over. They don't shut down. There's really all that other long-winded stuff. That's your anxiety that you're asking them to contain. They're not little adults. It's one of my soapbox discussions with people. That children are not miniature adults. And when we treat them, talk to them like they are, when we need them to understand, to agree, to absorb, to validate our thinking, our reasoning, our ideas, our boundaries, our consequences, our limits, our principles, we're asking them to be adults. Instead of just saying, here's the deal, here's what I'm comfortable with, I may be wrong, you can be mad if you want. And maybe I am wrong. Now, who knows? Heaven knows I've made so many mistakes in my life already. I'd be sure this isn't another one, but this is my boundary. You are something different than they are. Right? The adult brain, the adult filter, the parenting brain, the parenting filter is a different thing than the child brain. All right. Open for questions. First question, first comment. You talk about not verbalizing feelings to the child because they shouldn't be responsible to hold our feelings. I know that the impact letter is written to let the child know that his or her behavior impacted us, the family, those around him. I know the rationale is to open their eyes, but it isn't the result. Even if the motivation is pure, at least partially putting our feelings onto them. We don't do the impact letter anymore. We stopped doing that last year. And I'm actually in the middle of writing, been busy lately, so I haven't finished. And I'm writing an open letter to the therapeutic field, the wilderness therapeutic field, imploring programs to stop writing the impact. So I'll post that on our social media when it comes out. But I've been trying to teach around, justify, rationalize the impact letter for 20 years, and I've had enough. We call it the hopes and intentions letter now. And I just finally decided that the name itself makes an implication that I know is fundamentally against everything we know about child development, about the parent-child relationship, and about motivation for change. So I'm done with it. And we changed the name last year. During the 2.5 years my son went to treatment, I felt like the goal was transparency, honesty between us. Now that he's home, he's been lying a lot. If I understand what you said correctly, I shouldn't be concerned about his lying, rather listen to the message behind his lying. But doesn't letting him lie undermine our trust and our relationship now, just as it did prior to treatment? I'm not saying that if he lies to you about where he's going, if he lies to you about feeling, if he lies to you about boundaries, limits, expectations, that's a different thing. That you can have consequences, absolutely, have boundaries around them. I'm talking about the lies that they tell when they say, my mother was the meanest mother that ever lived. Right? My father never listened to me. In fact, he was verbally abusive. I'm talking about the lies and the story they tell about the experience of their life. I'm not talking about lies that they can be accountable for, because there are things like boundaries, limits, structure, consequences, curfew, those kinds of things. That's perfectly fine to hold accountability. I'm talking about the lies and the emotional story that they tell. I'm not safe because I have judged and tried to fix, a parent says, and he understandably feels that nothing is ever good enough. So now to see him feels like judgment. He doesn't want me to see his pain, wounds, anxiety, etc. I think he feels that that's all I ever see. What's wrong or broken? How do I prep the soil in the current emotional desert? Great question. I said goodbye to my boys last night because I turned the group back over to Dr. Hoig, my partner. And I found myself getting very emotional. And I said to them that I love them and that I hope that at least for 5 minutes, at some point, I was able to see them. And I told them that if I could see them for 5 minutes and they could feel that, that somewhere in the back of their head, they would know that nothing's wrong with them, that they're not broken. Yes, they do stupid stuff sometimes, just as I do, but that there's nothing fundamentally wrong with them and that they're okay. And that if they know that earlier in life, then they will spend the rest of their life giving gifts to the world instead of proving to the world that they're okay because they already are. And so I don't know the specifics of your story, but I think my response would be just apologize. Just try to listen to what he's asking. Even as he says to you, complains about your current behavior, even though you've changed, try to understand what he's saying. Respond to it, empathize with it. Respect it if you can. Again, all of this, you get to have your boundaries. You get to have those. But in the emotional context, if he says, I can't trust you, say, thanks for telling me. I get it. I see why you wouldn't want to show yourself to respect. You know, it's one of the most, it's a statement that I think is one of the most challenging but important statements to respond to when a child says, I don't trust you. I don't want to talk to you. And then you can say, I get it. Thanks for telling me that. I'm sure I haven't been trustworthy. And you're not going to get an immediate capitulation, but over time they'll recognize that you're not safe. But if there's an agenda, you need something from them, right? They'll feel that. They'll still sense that you're doing the same thing. Someone says, I always learn something new when I listen, and tonight I found a new personal insight in your discussion of anxiety, safety, and serenity. Thank you. You're absolutely welcome. I love doing these. It's. I tell my children, just imagine how crazy I would be if this was untreated. The message about the kids have the answer and we need to give them the safe place is resonating with me. I'm getting closer, but it seems a shame that having Albert Einstein for a father and Hedy Lamarr for a mother doesn't give an adopted child any inspiration or enlightenment. Right? Absolutely. All right, folks. I'll go to upcoming events, and then any last questions before we close. Please attend 6 12-step support groups before your child leaves. Start now. Some version of Al-Anon, CODA, or Families Anonymous. You can also go to NAMI.org to find free resources and classes in your area. On social media, you can find all of these broadcasts on the podcast app on an iPhone device. Just search Evoke Therapy Programs on your iPod podcast app. If you have an Android, download the SoundCloud app and search Evoke Therapy Program. Or you can go to the SoundCloud app on a desktop and search Evoke Therapy Programs on a computer. On Twitter and Instagram, you can find us at Evoke Therapy. On Facebook, you can search Evoke Therapy Programs. You can also find the Evoke Family Foundation on Facebook if you want to be involved in giving to people, supporting people who can't afford treatment. And of course, the Evoke Therapy blog is a wonderful resource. My book, The Journey of the Heroic Parent, is available on Amazon. Audible versions, CD versions are available. You can also buy a paperback. The warehouse had to return a bunch of books that were misprinted. So if you go to the paperback option and click under the 9 new, you'll see the Evoke Therapy Programs option to buy there. Same prices. In fact, no taxes added. The next workshop, if you can go to it, the next workshop is December 8th and 9th. For some of you, that might be too late, but for current families, we want all current families to go. Contact Melanie at evoketherapy.com for more information. If you want to do a deep dive in your own work, we have a couple of spots left in the November 7th, Finding You. Please seek this out. It's the best thing that you could do advance to the cause in your family. It's the best contribution that I know that you can make to your child's growth and maintaining their growth is to do this kind of work. The next, it's November 7th and through 11th. For Finding You Too, if you've been to a Finding You, you can go to Finding You Too. The next one is the one I'm running on November 25th to 29th. Alumni Intensive, December 12th through 16th. If your child is 18 at the time of this intensive and has been through our wilderness program and they want to do something, it's not wilderness therapy, it's only 4.5 days, they can come and do some of this work. You can also do private intensives. Go to our website for more information. I made a mistake in my previous slides. I will be in Chicago on November 7th, 7 to 9 p.m. at the Renaissance Marriott on Skokie Boulevard. So 7 to 9 p.m., November 7th, not November 6th. New York City will have a parent support group on November 12th. I'll be in Philadelphia on Wednesday, November 14th. Pursuits trips are for families or young adults who want to refresh or want to do something therapeutic but enjoyable. Think therapy, light, or sober fun. Any last questions? One last comment. So glad to hear you are making a statement about the impact of it. Thank you. If I can just finish it up and send it out, be happy to. Next question. My son spent a year in a treatment, and now he is a year and a half behind his friends in his college education. He deals with this frustration by blaming me for sending him. I understand the concept of pseudo-stupidity, so I don't offer explanation and empathize. However, keeps repeating himself, and I feel frustrated and trapped. My impulse is to end the conversation, but is this unempathic? Great question. I have two thoughts to that question. It's a great question. One thing I might add is you could say, maybe I was wrong. I don't know. I have self-doubt about it. You might be right. And if I'm wrong, if it was the wrong choice, I'm sorry. It's okay to say that. Right? It's okay to say that. But number two, it is okay to say, I can't hear this. See, we get to have a capacity that is limited. There are days when my children can walk through my office door and tell me to F off. And there are days when I would say, have a seat and tell me what's wrong. Then there are other days when they breathe too loud and I want to strangle them. So my capacity waxes and wanes. And it's okay to say to anybody, I can listen to this. I can't listen to this. You're allowed to cut off a conversation. That's okay. You can ask him, what do you need from me that I'm not giving you? I don't know what you want from me. Do you want a pound of flesh? It sounds like you want something more. You want me to hurt with you. Maybe the apology could help. Maybe I was wrong for him. I don't know. I did the best that I could, but it could have been the wrong decision. But you can also ask them, what do you want that you're not getting because you seem to be repeating yourself? People don't know sometimes. They want the other person to suffer and be in pain. It's the only way that they'll feel connected or empathize with them. That's not necessarily appropriate or healthy. It's not differentiating. And it absolutely is okay at any point in any conversation for any of you to say, I can't do this right now. This is my limit. I can't go any farther. That's appropriate. It's not saying you're wrong, stop talking. It's saying, I can't. Just own it. All right, I'm going to be traveling a bit. I'm going to be in Chicago next week, speaking in Park City, Utah on Monday night, traveling to Chicago Tuesday. I'll be in Chicago Wednesday and Thursday doing some different events. So I can do a broadcast next week. My next broadcast will be on Thursday, November 12th at 7. It'll be actually at 7 p.m., not 7:30 p.m. 7 p.m. on Thursday, November 12th. So I'll come up with a title for then. Have a great week, folks. I hope these points of contact are helpful to you. I know they're helpful for me. Have a great weekend. Take care, and I'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.